composition. They don't wipe everything out, start over, but they change the composition or make a shift. Some of those things might be like disease. If you get a disease that comes in and affects one particular species, that might make a big change in vegetation, but it doesn't destroy it, it just alters the stand. You know what I mean when I say stand? That term is just a kind of a geographic area, you know, the plants in a particular sort of homogeneous area or group. Another stand-altering disturbance might be wind. Sometimes wind effects, blowdown, can be really dramatic. Low-intensity fire. Of course, there's lots of kinds of fire, and fire is a very big player in the vegetation. But it's helpful to think of it, I think, just in terms of these two categories. Of course, they overlap a lot, but one is high-intensity fire, which might destroy everything and be a stand-replacing event. Or low-intensity fire, which might just go through a stand and make some changes in what the vegetation looks like. And then another stand-altering or vegetation-altering kind of disturbance is weeds. The introduction of species from somewhere else that might be invasive or have fairly major effects. And I put this other migration in here as well as weeds, because there's other plants that we wouldn't call a weed that are moving into the area slowly. The example that I used to like to think of is there's a plant called wood sorrel. Does anybody know what wood sorrel is? It looks like a clover. But it has fairly large white flowers. The flowers aren't anything like a clover flower. But it's really common from around Olympia in Washington South. And it's a good native plant. It's very widespread down into Oregon, California. And what we understand is that was pushed south by the glaciation as far as Olympia, which is the terminus of the glacier, the continental glacier. And it's been slowly migrating north. And I've heard it said that the wood sorrel is moving north at around 3 feet a day. I mean, that's an average, but you know, you can calculate that given enough time, that would migrate back up north. And so that's this idea of migration. If you think of a glacier being here in this valley and then receding, there would be no plants in the valley. And everything that came here had to migrate from somewhere else. So migration is another agent of change. And I also separated out human activity. Humans are a big player in the ecology, and we tend to think of humans as being an unnatural effect. You know, we think of what's a natural effect or what's a human effect, and it's an imperfect separation to think of humans as being one thing and nature to be another. But it is useful to think about it, because those are the things that we have control over. And some of the agents of human stand-altering disturbance have been fire suppression. Probably this is the biggest effect that we've had in the forest and the vegetation overall in the West, has been fire suppression. Or even in North America, not just in the West. Selective logging, where it alters the stand. You know, certain species are taken out, maybe the Douglas fir is removed and the other species are left. Or in some areas, the big red cedar are taken out and other species are left. Now that's a stand-altering effect. And dispersal is actually a fairly major thing to think about. I saw a talk recently by Jerry Franklin, who's sort of one of the most prominent foresters in the Northwest, and he's been a proponent of trying to develop a method of forestry that was more in sync with the natural processes. And he said that he thinks the biggest threat to the Northwest ecology is going to be new diseases that will come in. Forest insect pests or other kinds of diseases, fungal diseases. And we have lots of examples of those, like in the East we have the Dutch elm disease and the chestnut blight, diseases that came in and had a big effect. And he's very concerned about humans, but because we move all over the globe so much, and we, in this globalization of our economy, we move materials around the globe. We move a lot of wood around and plant material, and that's going to be a real, it presents a real danger for moving diseases around. So those are stand-altering disturbances. And then stand-replacing is where you really have a major impact or a major event which completely removes the vegetation. And then the vegetation starts over again. And those kinds of stand-replacing events might be high-intensity fire, where it really is hot and dry enough to kill essentially everything that's living on the site. Volcanic activity, another very high-intensity effect. Mount St. Helens, I regret I don't have any good photographs of Mount St. Helens, but that's a great example of a stand-replacing event, to say the least. And glaciation, something happens on a much slower scale, slower time frame, but also is stand-replacing in that it just removes the vegetation. And very small-scale landslides, if you have a landslide and you end up with a big patch of bare ground. And then in human activity, we could think of clear-cutting as a forest practice that is stand-replacing. It doesn't go in and select out everything, but basically removes the forest and starts again at ground zero. And agriculture, that's another case where the vegetation is basically removed, and then processes of development start over. I grew up in New England, and in New England, you probably know, back 200 years ago, a lot of the forests had been cleared for agriculture. But when agriculture shifted to the west, a lot of that land was just abandoned, and it's grown back up into forests. And so it's very interesting to go out there and think of the fact that that had had a stand-replacing event of removing the forest, and now it's, in many areas, getting to where it's a mature forest again. And so then they can consider, you know, forestry kinds of options. So I don't want to put any value judgment on these as good or bad, but just to say these are, you know, big effects. Succession is the word that we use to mean the progressive change of vegetation on a site. If you think of a piece of bare ground and the first plants come in and they occupy it, and then they change the environment, maybe originally it's open bare ground and they might create shade, and because of those changed conditions, different species come in and replace them. So we have these waves of succession, which progresses to we think of succession as progressing to what might be called a climatic. We used to think, this term is not in favor very much, climatic climax. Or equilibrium. More often now they talk about potential natural vegetation. And I think this is the only acronym I'll give you, but I'll just say PNC. Just that's what it is. Oh, potential natural community. The acronym. I remember the acronym is PNC. So the acronym probably is important, but the idea is that we have this concept that if things went along, if succession progressed long enough without disturbance, that eventually you'd have some kind of equilibrium where the vegetation would continue to be like that. And in most cases, that doesn't exist very often. The best example I can give you is in the Western Washington, we have these extensive forests in an area we would call the Western Hemlock Zone. That's our most extensive forest. And we think that the potential natural community or potential natural vegetation there would be a western hemlock. But when Europeans first came here, they didn't find western hemlock forest, they found Douglas fir. And that's because Douglas fir is an earlier stage in this process of succession. And succession is just, I mean, disturbance is just something that happens through fire or some other natural processes. And then the last one, I'm not going to talk about much, is genetic change. I just wanted to put it in there because it is a major agent in the long term in this in these changes. And even in the short term, there's some noxious weeds that seem to show the capability of going through genetic change fairly rapidly. And so sort of jumping their habitat. For example, there's this reed canary grass, which is a bad invader in wetlands. And it seems to be that it has ability to jump out of that wetland habitat and go through genetic change and adapt to adjacent habitats. And that is at least sometimes a characteristic of some real serious weeds, that they can kind of jump their habitat and become interested in places where you don't expect them. So that's sort of our outline of change. You know, you came in late, I forgot your name.
Bob,
yeah, you know, there's three handouts here, and I'll give them to you. They don't pertain directly to what we're doing right now, but they did, they're sort of the background. They have been the background of the other parts of this whole series on vegetation in the North Cascades, so you might find them useful.
Thank you.
So, there's our outline. I assume you have any questions about that before? Did you?
One of my daughter's most favorite videos is the eruption of Mount St. Helens.
Oh,
the video is already like 10 years old. But at the time, well, at that time, they explained how everything was just completely devastated, even more than in the fire. There was just absolutely nothing, and that the area was really crawling with button nests because they were so fascinated about seeing what started growing back. And and I guess by today it's pretty much there's some grown trees and
there's a lot of vegetation there.
Yeah.
You know, I have to say I've not been to Mount St. Helens.
You have not ever?
And I can't believe that, but that's I don't know. It seems that a lot of my traveling is work related, and just so happens I haven't had any work in Mount St. Helens, but every year we say, you know, we just have to go to Mount St. Helens this year.
It's
we
really
have
really fascinating.
So anyway, well, let me show you some pictures, and we'll kind of go through that same general. We'll use that out as an outline, at least on the board, and talk about climatic change. And then we'll talk about mostly about fire, but some other disturbance. Is everyone from Washington here, or where are folks from? How many people are from Washington?
I grew up in California.
And where do you live now?
Washington.
Oh, okay, so everybody lives in Washington.
Yeah.
Okay, well, gee, you know, I have a little mini section on Minnesota.
Oh.
Because there's so many people that come here from Minnesota, and I had the opportunity to work on a couple projects out there. So if we don't get to Minnesota, that'll be okay, because you're all from Washington, so. Okay. Well, this first little section, I was just going to talk about climatic change. And you might recognize this place. Carol, you might recognize this.
Lake Chelan on the
that's
north
right.
side of the lake.
Right, on the other side of the lake. And this is, that's Prince Creek.
Wow.
And, you know, the alluvial fan of Prince Creek. I didn't think about it, but if we were talking about disturbance, there's a great example. Right there, because it was a big flood that came down that creek bed in 1948. It basically wiped out, there was a Boy Scout camp and a Forest Service guard station.
Yeah.
And removed the vegetation from that whole fan. and of course the vegetation started back up again. But what I put the slide in here for was to show you this group of trees here, or plants. And this is the manzanita stand that is only found, it's the only place I know of in Washington where this manzanita grows. There may be some other occurrences down in the Columbia Gorge. But this is a person standing here, it's my colleague. So, he's 6 feet tall, and it's not really that, it's probably 8 or 10 feet tall. And this is one little pocket on this south-facing slope above Lake Chelan. And in looking at it, the only real explanation we can have for it being there is that during that hypsothermal, during that hot, dry period, because it had to be warm and dry for a long time for these plants to move that far, that this manzanita spread north. And then as the climate cooled, it mostly was wiped out or squeezed out. But this steep south-facing slope here just happened to be a refugium where it could hang on. Now, if it's the only species, it might be possible to think, well, it could be that someone planted it there, because people do that. They plant things around. But there are two or three other species in the same part of the lake which are also disjunct from a long way south. The other one, I don't have a photo of it here, but was a type of fern. It's called Sierra Cliffbrake. And it's not found in Washington, it's not found in Oregon. It's only found in California. And it also happens to grow along Lake Chelan. So it's far north of where it usually grows. And it had not been known from this area until we saw it. And there's another species, which is a species of orchid, a bog orchid. And it's a rare plant in Washington that is more common to the south, and just happens to occur in a few places throughout Washington. But this is one of them also, the south-facing slope. So, very interesting area.
How would that have traveled, by wind or birds?
Well, probably by birds. It has berries like kinnikinick, if you know what kinnikinick is, little red berries, or like madrone, big tree madrone. It does produce berries that are carried by birds.
I'm pretty sure I've seen manzanita in other places too, like near Moorpoint.
Near where? Moorpoint?
Near Moorpoint.
Well,
same shoreline.
Yeah, same shoreline. When we did this study, there are a lot of plants that are about 3 feet high, mm-hmm. along the lakeshore trail.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no native species of this is the genus Arctostaphylos. So it's manzanita and kinnikinick. I don't know if you know what kinnikinick is, but there's a native one that's about 3 inches tall.
That's a kinnikinick.
That's kinnikinick, and it's common. And then there's this thing, which only occurs right here, and then there's a bunch that seem to be about 3 feet high.
Yeah.
And I thought they looked like they were some kind of a genetic introgression from this thing going into kinnikinick. A couple friends of mine later did a study along the lake, and they think that it's this thing, too.
So you're going
right? They think that it's this manzanita growing along the lake. So that's an evidence of climatic change, or changes in the vegetation due to climatic fluctuation. And going the other way, there's some evidences of periods when the climate was cooler. This is over also on the other side of the lake. And up this is, you can't really see the water here, but this is Surprise Lake. There's two stands of mountain hemlock, that's what this tree is right here, that occur over there on Sawtooth Ridge. One is right here above Surprise Lake, one is above another lake called Cub Lake. But they're both very steep north-facing slopes where it's a little more moist, a little more shaded. And that those are the only stands of that tree. And it's not just that species, I think there's also silver fir in there. And I think there's also a white rhododendron, which is associated with it. It's not limited to that area. But these two stands are the only places in Sawtooth Ridge that have this mountain hemlock. If we you go to the west, where it's cooler and moister, there's tons of them. So our interpretation, my interpretation, is that this is a remnant of a period when it was cooler and these trees were spread all over the landscape. It's a little hard to date that one because the distribution is not so far. It's like 20 miles or 30 miles. And it could have been, it could go back to the Ice Ages where mountains and hemlock was everywhere at the end of the Ice Age. Or it could have been a more recent dispersal. But it is a relic and a remnant population. And to me, that's evidence of these fluctuations because of climate. And then another more recent climatic event, which we all have heard about, and I guess none of us lived through it, but the Dust Bowl era in the late 20s and 30s, we had a series of years that were hot and dry. You know, we've all heard the stories of the Dust Bowl and the drought and the effects on human agriculture and things like that. But there's a lot of physical evidence in the North Cascades that result from this climatic event. That these upper meadows, this is a subalpine meadow, it's a very rocky one, but they're kept tree-free because of snowpack. Snowpack lies in there for a lot of the year and prevents trees from getting established. But during that period in the early 30s, the snow melted out much earlier. And so trees were able to invade those meadows. And there's been studies throughout the Cascades showing invasion of subalpine meadows dating to those years. And this is a subalpine larch. Disregard this for the moment, but most of these are subalpine larch, which is a very high elevation tree in the mountains here. And that's the one that I see in Sawtooth Ridge being the biggest invader. But the literature shows that other species have also done the same thing.
About what altitude is that?
I would guess it's maybe 7,000 feet or something like that.
And what do you say the snag is? That's a subalpine larch as well?
Yeah, the snag is the same thing, but it's a relic of another period.
Right.
You know, so it almost looks like a relic of a warm period. I'm not quite sure if I can safely say that that's a relic of, you know, there was a period about 600 years ago that it was warmer. Not as warm as this hypsothermal interval. It was 6,000 years ago, but in human history, you know, written human history, there was a fairly warm, dry period where Greenland was settled by Europeans, you know, Iceland and Greenland. They were able to establish colonies there. And I didn't realize this until I started studying plants, but the reason they were able to do that was because the climate was warmer. And they got communities established, and then the climate cooled off around 500 years ago, I think it was the early 1400s, and wiped out those settlements. And so it might be that this tree is a relic of that warmer period, you know, 600 years ago. I'm guessing at that. I can't really say that's the case, but you know, it's way above where most of us be. Big larches are. So that's climatic fluctuation, climatic change in how it changes the vegetation. The next section I wanted to talk about, just really briefly, is other kinds of disturbance. And this one is a fairly high mountain stand, and these dead snags here are whitebark pine. And these living trees are subalpine fir. And what this reflects is that there was an infestation of a disease, probably a white pine bark beetles of some kind, that went in and killed off, not completely, but most of the pines. And so it's a stand-altering event. The pines are still, the species is still there. If you walk through this area of the woods, you'll find that there's still white bark pine that's alive and doing quite well. The disease is not there anymore. But it definitely caused a change in the vegetation because it went through and selectively affected the pines, but it had no effect on the fir. And we can see that around the village right now. There's some diseases affecting trees around the village. You've probably seen some. You can see a few dead trees. I don't know what the agent is in that dead case, but so that's a stand altering. I think that's about the only picture I have of disease. Then the next agent of change, and this next discussion is going to be about fire and effects of fire. And I'll try focusing on just a little bit. I'm going to kind of mix up high intensity and low intensity fire. Anyway, do you recognize this one, Carol, where that is?
Canoe Creek, maybe?
It's actually north of Canoe Creek. It's down pretty near, it's kind of below Cascade Basin, kind of just north of Round Mountain. And this was what I call the toilet paper fire of 1984. And there is a particular backcountry etiquette of burning your toilet paper, which I don't subscribe to, I never did. But, I've heard about it. And back in 1984, there were some medical students from Harvard Medical School just graduated. And they were hiking along the Lakeshore Trail. And they were burning their toilet paper, and it got away from them. And it started this fire. And this is just a little piece of it along the lakeshore, but it burned, I think, something like 5,000 acres or something. It wasn't a huge fire, but
legendary.
Yeah, but it's legendary. It's a good story. But you can see that the fire, I mean, it burned off all the understory, but at least in this little patch, it didn't really kill many of the trees. There's other areas up above where it got more intense and did cause, kill some trees. And I'll show you some pictures from the ground, but this is just looking down on it. And I wanted to use this as an example to show that there's a range of adaptations to fire, that fire has been a frequent part of the natural ecology here for a long time. And so the species that live here have developed strategies for dealing with it. And one of the strategies is that some species aren't killed by most fires, but only the above ground part is killed. And then it will re-sprout. These are big leaf maple. And they were killed off to the ground, but then they sprout abundantly. And if you walk over that hillside, you'll see there's some big specimens of big leaf maple, but they tend to look like shrubs because they have multiple trunks. And that's probably because they historically burned and sprouted. And this is another, little further on. This is about 4 years after the fire. And you can see that this is the tree that was killed. It was already multiple stems. It wasn't like a single trunk like in Western Washington. So it had probably already been burned and killed to the ground. It sprouted up. It grew into a big tree. And then it was burned again. And so it really isn't a big setback for that species. You can see these are ponderosa pine in the back. And they're also very, as the tree gets older, the bark is thick and it's quite fire resistant. And so the big ones are quite able to withstand low intensity fire. And Douglas fir, this is our most common conifer here in the valley, Douglas fir. It is also quite resistant to low intensity fire. And this is a grassland. This happens to be on the other side of the lake, but on Horton Butte. But this has been burned, these grasses would burn very readily. And as long as it was a low intensity fire, the Douglas fir is able to withstand that. So this is a living tree, but it's experienced fire from the past. So that thick bark is one adaptation, survive the fire. Another adaptation is sprout from the roots, which a number of plants do, and some plants don't. More than one strategy works. This is going to show another strategy. This is a lodgepole pine stand, and this is an old snag from Douglas fir. And what happened on this site is that there was an old forest, probably Douglas fir, and a fire came through here, fairly hot fire, hot enough to kill the mature trees. And then this lodgepole pine has a strategy of putting out lots of seed through its life cycle, to where the soil is full of seeds and the cones themselves retain seeds inside the cones. And when fire goes through, those cones pop open and the seeds are distributed, and they are the seed source for a new forest. And this is what that forest might look like. They tend to be these very thick, they call them dog hair stands of pines. And you can see the trunks very close together and straight. And that's why it's called lodgepole pine, because those were great building material for lodges or other things that needed straight timber. And it's another totally different species, but with a similar strategy in a way. You can't really tell it's there, but I'll tell you that all through here are thousands and thousands of seedlings of this plant called it's a globe mallow, type of globe mallow. And it's a rare plant in Washington. And a bunch of years ago, I had a job for the state, and my job was to go sort of monitor known populations of different species, but including this rare globe mallow. And there have been some populations up in this area that were recorded at maybe, for example, like 6 individuals of this species, or, you know, 1 or 10, very low number of this rare plant. And wanted to know how it did in the fire, so I went back to a lot of these sites. And it's a fire, also a fire-adapted species. There were literally thousands of new individuals of this rare plant. In fact, I would suspect that it's very likely it's going to be delisted, because they found that it's not that rare if there's enough occurrence of fire. So that was the strategy. And another strategy of a very different kind of species is this. This is, you know what this is? Where are we? Recognize fireweed? And it's called fireweed because it is a very great colonizer after fire. And I don't know if they call it fireweed because it looks kind of like fire too.
It has color.
But, you know, it's got these little seeds that are carried on the wind, and when there's a ground disturbance like a fire, it's one of the species that's really able to get established, seed itself in by wind-borne seed, and then once the plants get growing, they form colonies because they send rhizomes underground and send up new shoots. And it can be very aggressive. I've heard of the rhizomes going under city sidewalks and coming up on the other side. Most people don't plant that in a garden, but I did know somebody did. Well, this is another fire. This is called the Thunder Fire, or Thunder Mountain Fire. And this was around 1990, or maybe 92, up in Okanagan County. And I wanted to show, first of all, it was a big fire. It was a very high-intensity fire. See these dark patches? In these dark areas, those were stand replacing disturbances. It essentially killed everything in those patches. But you can also see that it really is a very patchy, a big fire like that is a very patchy event. And there's these little patches here which will be replaced, but a lot of this forest is still surviving. And that survival probably isn't because they were able to successfully fight the fire, it's probably because that's the way the fire went. And this is on the ground looking at that. And you can see where we're standing. This area right here was a high intensity burn and killed everything. But right over here we have meadows that were not burned. Those actually might have been protected by the fire. I think this is pretty near protected by firefighting, because I think there's a fire line over there. And this is what that stand looked like. It really did, in some areas, cook it. But you can see what the species is. That's that lodgepole pine. And it was one of these dog hair stands. It was easy for a really hot fire to get going because there's so much fuel in here. It's so close together. And it just crowned. But you can bet that if you go back there, if we went back there today, it probably would be a young stand of the same species. Because there's all that seed. This is just another fire. This is in Northrop Canyon over by the Grand Coulee. It's a little forested canyon. They had a fire last year, and we went in there. We had been there the year before doing a plant study, so we went in last year, or this year, to see how it looked, and this is just showing that it's a very patchy kind of fire. We'll call that an example of a low-intensity fire. This is sort of a classic open ponderosa pine stand where a low intensity fire would just burn through this understory. Most of these trees weren't killed, but all the competing vegetation was wiped out. If we had gone down Lake Chelan 100 years ago, we probably would have seen forests that looked much more like this than what we see today. We think there's a lot more historic fire that kept the understory clear in a lot of places, and kept a more scattered stands of these big trees. But since we've been so successful at fire suppression, a forest has grown up around those, so we get a really dense forest. And that's really the story all over the West. We've been so successful at fire suppression, we've set up a dangerous situation in a lot of ways. So my main lesson, I guess, I'm talking about lots of things, but would be that there's these two kinds of fire. You know, it's a generality, but there's this one kind of fire which is low intensity and burns the understory, and a lot of things survive it. And the other kind of fire is high intensity, which basically burns everything.
What are the conditions that create those two?
Well, one would be like this kind of a place, there isn't a lot of fuel. And so if a fire gets started, it's easy for it to just creep along the ground and burn a few shrubs here, or an occasional tree. But the trees aren't close enough really to carry a crown fire. And there may not be a lot of stuff, like if a fire went through right here now, there's not much to carry the fire up into the tops of the trees. But if you had shrubs growing all through there, or young trees, you know, 10, 20 feet tall, they might act as ladders to carry the fire up into the canopy. So that might be one case where you might have a low intensity fire.
So with fire suppression, removing forests that are susceptible to high intensity fire?
That's right. More susceptible. That's the generality throughout the country, really. And so it's really difficult to figure out what to do now, because if we let it burn now, it's more likely to be high intensity. Plus, you know, a lot of these areas are settled, there's people living there. And so there's big efforts, the efforts I've been involved in are in California and in Minnesota, but big efforts to try to go in and do burning at the right time of year.
when there's no moisture, so you can do controlled burning, start to reduce this buildup of fuel, and start to get back to an earlier condition where fires may not be so catastrophic.
Would you burn an area, or just try to have a low intensity fire?
Well, they tend to do it in patches. You know, and in the Boundary Waters case, that's the one I know the best, there are all these lakes, you know, that's the great thing about Boundary Water. And so they use the lakes as part of a fire break. So they do computer modeling to figure, well, where can we put a small patch controlled burn that's going to act as a most effectively as a fire break? You know, so it's sort of like a strategy of trying to, you know, establish places so you can protect communities. And otherwise, their primary concern is the towns nearby. In California, it's a different condition, and what they're trying to do are establish these, they call them defensible fuel profile zones. They're like places where, if there is a fire, we could effectively fight a fire. So they use areas along roads, they might clear out, you know, understory along the roads, or they might, you know, just decide a certain ridge top is going to be their zone of defense, and so they'll try to go in and take out a certain number of trees. There's quite a bit of support for that. It's still controversial because it's, you know, some people don't like to see any tree removal in some areas. Or some people don't like to see any fire being set. So. This is a little bit dark, but in that same area, the previous slide, the fire wasn't very intense because there wasn't much fuel. But this was a wetland. In wet years. In dry years, it's not wet at all, but it had a lot more vegetation in it than most of the surrounding area. And the fire actually burned quite hot through there. And this is a little dark, but this is a type of bulrush, the stand of a type of bulrush, which is a wetland plant. And the fire had gone in, totally burned off all the organic material, and we thought this was probably going to kill the plants, but here they are sprouting again. So even though that was a really, in that one little patch, quite high intensity, the plants were able to survive. Does it look to you a little bit like a forest? Or can you tell how big those plants are? My hope was that it would look like a forest, but just to give you a sense of scale, this crater right here, that's a horse print, hoof print. So it did look like a forest.
Oh. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Oh, great. Okay, then the biggest scale of stand replacing disturbance, which again, I'm not trying to put a value judgment, I'm just pointing out that this is an ecological change, is looking at human agriculture. And these aren't areas, in this case, this is Eastern Washington, they aren't areas that were forested, but they're areas where the prior natural communities were basically removed, completely removed for agriculture. And this is wheat up in the Waterville Plateau. And this is over in the Palouse, over in Eastern Washington. This is a very rich wheat growing country. And I was fortunate to spend some time working over there one fall, and I think it's a really beautiful country. And to think of the amount of food that comes out of there, it's astounding. I like to sit there sometimes and wonder what that would have looked like before any European-type agriculture. And also to think that there were probably people living there for certainly thousands of years, maybe tens of thousands of years. And they probably didn't have any effect that you could see.
Didn't have what?
Any effect that you could see.
Uh-huh.
If you
you were to look at it from distance. And so we've had a pretty major effect.
What did it look like?
Well, I think it was a grassland. It was a bunch grass. There's a whole array of native bunch grasses.
Are there any sections that are preserved?
Not very much. The only places that have natural vegetation out here where the soil is really good are little eyebrows that are too steep for a plow. And so if they can't get a plow there, I was over there looking for rare plants for the state, and if you find these little eyebrows, they still have the prior vegetation to some extent. A lot of shrubs also. You know, different kinds of snowberry like we have in the valley here, and different kinds of wild roses. But a lot of the common, what I bet were common Palouse species at that time are now rare plants because there's only very little piece of habitat. In fact, I think this is the most altered ecology of anywhere in our state.
Is this irrigated?
No, this is all dry land.
Like, it's similar to the high plains across the river from Chelan, right?
Yeah, well, in fact, this one back here, this is across from Chelan.
Oh.
This is Waterville.
Okay. Yeah.
Like around Waterville, just kind of east of Waterville.
They only plant every other year.
Yeah, they don't. They keep ground. Oh, that's why this, I think why the other side of the hill is fallow right here is because they're letting the moisture build up for a year. So they can plant a crop the next year. And the same here. This is, you know, some of this has just been harvested. This is like September. And some of this, you know, I'm not a farmer. I've never really been around or been involved in growing this kind of crop. So I'm not sure. I know they plant other crops too. They rotate with legumes and things like that. So that's, and I think that the challenge is how to, you know, provide for ourselves and at the same time have some regard for, you know, the natural systems. And I think that ultimately we're going to find that when we're able to most effectively safeguard those natural systems, we're going to have the healthiest conditions for ourselves. So, anyway, that's... That was all the material I had to cover.
So you
want
to get to Minnesota?
Oh, you want to get to Minnesota? Let's see, it's 5:50. I'd be happy to give you a little Minnesota tour. Let's move on to Minnesota. Does anyone know what this species is? Could you guess? Does it look like anything we have here?
It's like a tree.
Oh, pardon?
Oh, our neighbor has a tree.
Yeah, it's a white pine, just like we have in the valley here, but this one's an eastern white pine. And I was quite surprised how similar the ecology is in Minnesota to here. You know, I described the two kinds of fire, high intensity and low intensity fire, and the two kinds of adaptation. They have the very same story there. The white pine, and there's another pine, red pine, act just like Douglas fir and ponderosa pine. That they're fire resistant, and they are most developed in stands where there's frequent low intensity fire, and tends to keep the understory down and preserve this these big specimens in kind of a patchy landscape. And the other bunch of species is the most common one is called jack pine. And it's just like lodgepole pine. It's an adaptation, or it's adapted to high intensity fire, where you have a stand replacing event and completely remove the vegetation. And it's got the same strategy for releasing seeds from cones. So those seeds are stimulated by fire to germinate, and they form these same dog hair stands, like our lodgepole. So I'll just show you a couple pictures. Actually, the reason I was there was on 4th of July 1999, they had a big windstorm. Anybody hear about that? Over here?
in about 20 minutes on the 4th of July, something on the neighborhood of 400,000 acres of trees will be down. And they call it a derecho, which is kind of like a tornado, but the way I understand it, it's the, for some reason, the jet stream dips down, and you get these very high intensity focused winds.
What's that term again?
Derecho. D-E-R-E-C-H-O. Derecho.
Yes, I heard about that. I did, and it did do a lot of damage to the houses, to the homes, too, I think, in the city.
Yeah. It's interesting, if you look at a map of where the impacts were, because we had lots of, you know, generated maps of where the high-intensity blowdown was. The center was in the Boundary Water Wilderness. And it extended outside and also extended over the Canadian border, but most of it would stop right at the Canadian border. It was really peculiar. I mean, they had a little bit of it, but almost all of it was on the state's side. And it was very sudden and intense. And historically, apparently they've had blowdowns like that, but nowhere near that size. You know, there's evidence in the ecology, the forest, you know, this stand ages and other kinds of evidence that when Europeans first came here, they saw those maybe tens of thousands of the most, or maybe thousands of acres in size, but nothing of the scale of this.
What lake is that?
I can't tell you the name of that one. There's so many lakes. I was on a few of them. I know about 20 of them from the water, but from the air I couldn't tell you.
This is northern Minnesota.
Northern Canada. Yeah, right on the Canadian border. And I'll show you a picture here that shows there's some blowdown. And this, you can see this area right here. This is an area. So it was kind of like, it's patchy, just like a fire. And it just slammed down those trees. And the concern was that all that dead wood on the ground would present a real danger for fire. And there's settlements, you know, there's a town, several towns that are kind of stuck up into the wilderness. And so they're afraid the towns were going to be at risk. So they're trying to think of ways to reduce that danger. And so we were analyzing the potential effects of going in and burning that fuel. And this is from the ground. And even in the areas that were the worst, rarely were all the trees blown down. It's usually patchy. And if you went through there, you'd find that paper birch was particularly able to withstand the wind.
I presume that what went down wasn't of economic value for logging?
Well, the wilderness is closed to logging.
Oh.
And also, because it's wilderness, it's not legal to salvage from it. And even if it was legal, because there's no road system and you'd have to weigh air, the limits of a helicopter type of salvage are something like a mile. And so we have, you know, 20, 30 miles into the wilderness, there'd be no way to remove it. This is right behind these trees, a big patch of blowdown, and you can see that that the blowdown was both patchy and also it seemed to be that right along the shoreline it was less damaging. And I think part of that is topography. You know, you have a hill and it drops down to the water. Trees that are over the edge of that hill have a little bit more protection. And here's some kind of jumble blowdown. You can see the pines and everything there. Some more blowdown. And I won't go into this. This is a fire. And this is probably on the order of 4 or 5 years old where this fire was. And this, there's no way to tell it by looking at it, but this is a prescribed burn where they're intentionally trying to
In this case, they're not trying to protect a community, but they're trying to reinstate fire as a natural process. There's a lot, well, for commercial reasons, the species they're interested in are the pines. And all of the pines have some kind of relationship with fire. So either this high intensity fire or the low intensity fire. And so they're trying to reestablish that because there's been a major reduction in pines.
So what was the major tree then that was burned?
I think those are probably mostly aspen.
I see.
And you can see this is probably, I can't tell them by sight, it could be red or white pine. Because they have those two strategies, you know, the white, red and white pine have this response to low intensity fire, that's what they need. And they're killed off by high intensity. And so they're trying to, you know, recreate these conditions where they can have a low intensity fire. This is showing, this is probably the worst blowdown we've walked through. That was the last one.
So that's, you worked for Washington State and then you went to Minnesota to study that particular thing?
Well, right now I don't work for Washington State. I work for a private consulting firm who most often works for the Forest Service in the work I do. But several years ago I worked for the state. That's when I was doing that very well. So that's a little glimpse of disturbance fire ecology succession. Anybody have any other questions? I always like it when people have want to know more.
You know, my grandparents homesteaded in California, about 50 miles from the Mojave Desert. And at that time, my mother said, you know, they planted a crop and, you know, there was, didn't have any problems with planting a crop and water and so forth. And now there's just sagebrush and rattlesnakes and rabbits.
And they didn't have any of those things before.
Rattlesnakes.
Is there a lot of grazing in the area?
I don't think so.
And what's
just change from crop producing, because they had to produce a crop, you know, when they homesteaded.
Yeah. What do they attribute those changes to?
I don't know.
That's what we asked you.
Yeah. I'd have to know more about that particular site. You know.
Is that the whole area that's wanted? Not just
the whole thing. Oh, I'm sure the whole area.
Yeah.
It's just, now they're building houses on it for some crazy reason. Houses everywhere, you know.
1990, we had a series of major storms in central Europe that literally, I mean, destroyed northern France and Germany and going into a little bit farther north too, and it knocked down woods. It was horrible. I have pictures, you see humongous trees being uprooted and then, you know, the almost wood system almost high as the house,
yeah,
lying everywhere.
Wow.
It was absolutely horrible, and they said that there was two factors to that. First of all, climatic change, unusual winds, and second, that where they had forested land, that they would use trees that to reforest that grow way too fast and are not sturdy enough, and the wind would just knock them over real quickly. But we also had like very, very big trees blown over. It was horrible.
I heard about it. Was it 1990?
I think so. 89 or 1990.
Yeah. Oh. I remember hearing about those. And I'd forgotten because you know, that was 10 years ago. But, but forests, really old forests.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, younger ones too.
Yeah. Well, all the models, you know, the models of the effect of global warming include increased intensity of storms. And so there's some evidence.
Thanks.
All right, great. Well, thank you for coming. And help you, if you didn't get them, help yourself to these three handouts.
Yeah, wonderful. Because it's like this.